We are so lucky to live in Wisconsin, aren't we? We have incredible natural areas and the wildlife that lives in our state. Really fascinating to watch and learn about. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us again on the Ideas Network. Really fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven with us as well. And he's here to talk about what's going on in the world of wildlife, both in and out of Wisconsin. And Scott, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back, Larry, except September show means summer's gone. I don't know where it went.
I don't know either.
Blinked and missed it, but here it is, the first week of school and the first week of some of the fall hunting seasons. And, of course, it's 90 degrees every day and humid. That's the way it seems to go every year. But anyway, it's good to be back. It's good to be looking fall square in the eye, which is my favorite season. But
yeah, it's a fun time, isn't it?
Sorry to see the summer in the garden fading and whatnot, but yeah. So it goes.
Well, you were recently on a trip to Isle Royale National Park in Michigan, and that was quite an adventure.
It was. Isle Royale, I had not been there, but a friend of mine who runs nature tours all over the continent and in some cases internationally asked me to go along and help lead the tour and to talk about it on your program, which we did quite a few months ago, and we ended up with 23 folks, which is on the large side of the tour groups for his operation. But it turned out that when we got together with the group up in Houghton, Michigan, where we launched on the Ranger 3 for the adventure over to Isle Royale, that the majority of the group were avid
public radio
listeners, heard about it on the program when you and I talked about it rather cryptically, and literally signed up or got their name in the mix right away that day, and it was a first-come, first-served situation. So when we asked people, you know, how did you come by your interest in this, in terms of visiting Iowa, well, we heard about it on public radio, and we wanted to go along and listen to Scott and so forth, and it was just great. It was just a wonderful group of people. The group dynamic was great. Everybody had a good sense of humor and was more than willing to head out on the trails, and there's a lot of hiking, which, I mean, I was a little concerned about that. I'm just sort of back after all those miserable health issues, but things went very well for me and the group, and it was just a weird situation knowing you had no contact with the outside world. No, cell phones didn't work, no real radio, TV comment. It was just
a different experience.
Somewhere else, and it was a true wilderness area. The park itself is, if it's not the least visited national park in the country, it's close to it. It's not easy to get to. It was a five and a half hour boat trip out from Houghton across Lake Superior, which can be something of a challenge. It was certainly cool. And the island itself is just a really unique biological community.
It's over 100 square miles, isn't it?
210,
yeah,
something 210. Like that, plus a lot of offshore water. I think the park boundaries extend 4+ miles out into the lake. So it's a big area. And there aren't, at any one time, I don't think there could be more than 500 people on the island. They can't service any more than that. And many of them are backpackers off in the hinterland where they're not seen. But it's a very, no ecosystem is really simple. But this one, at least, is not very diverse. And of course, the jewel in the whole thing is the interaction of wolf and moose that's been going on for quite a few decades and well studied. Everybody knows about the Isle Royale wolf and moose situation. And we just happened to be there at a kind of the culmination of the Park Service's fact finding on, okay, folks, what the heck should we do here? Because the wolves are all but gone and the moose are
multiplying
like moose do. And I think for the last 4 years, the moose population growth rate's been like 22%. So there may be, within 3 years, twice as many moose if something doesn't give.
Yeah.
And anyway, there's a big to-do over what to do. The group of us had an interesting evening discussion on that, and there were, opinions are varied amongst any group of people. But what to do about the wolf situation, they're on their way out, apparently. And what to do about the moose situation, they're burgeoning, is going to be a management challenge for the Park Service. So if people want to hear a little more about that, we'll talk about it. But it was a great trip, great group of people, really cool place in more ways than one. And I would urge anybody, it's not that far from here.
No.
You know, 6-hour drive and then take a boat out, and it's a neat place to visit.
David in Richland Center, hi.
Hi, Larry. Listen, I got to tell you, I love your show. Been listening to you for decades. Thank God for public radio. I've been educated with UW-Madison, but, you know, my education has continued with public radio, so I'm a good guy. But I love what your guest is saying. I was on Isle Royale with my new wife in 1979 when UW was heavily invested in studying what your guest just referred to in terms of the population of the moose and wolves. Of course, it was much better then. There was about 3 packs of wolves, and I forget how many moose, but they seem to be in nice balance. And, of course, over the years, we discovered that what happens when there isn't a good balance, and we discovered that in many areas, of course, in the country and the world. But it was a great time. I want to just relay a story. It was that we were climbing Mount Ojibwa, and that's a rugged island. People had warned me about how rough it was. Lois and I had hiked the Collegiate Range in Colorado. I had spent 7 years in Colorado, so we'd done some heavy hiking. But Isle Royale, there's nothing like Isle Royale. Very little topsoil, roots and rocks. So after a few days, we were already talking divorce, you know, because we were getting beat to death by the flies, by the, you know, the heavy hiking. We were backpacking. But anyway, we stayed together for quite a while, actually. But we're climbing Mount Ojibwa, and a storm came right up, as often happens on Lake Superior. And lightning started to strike, and luckily there was a ranger at a tower there. There's a lookout tower and a ranger tower. And he summoned us up. We were in the midst of a storm I've never seen before. Unbelievable. Lightning strikes everywhere. We were right in the middle of it, and luckily grounded and safe.
Wow.
Well, my impression now is that that's the kind of experience people have on Isle Royale. It is a rugged place, and that expression, roots and rocks, I mean, that's used to that day. All the Park Service people said when we were heading out on a trail, you know, hey, our trails are typified, they're narrow, and they're typified by R&R, roots and rocks. And it is, there's almost no level, flat, cushioned footing. So it's rigorous hiking, but there are miles and miles and miles of trails, remote inland lakes, pretty good fishing, and the well, as they say, we can deal with the moose wolf situation, but it's as we did one of the highlights, I think, was the group got to spend a big chunk of an afternoon with Rolf Peterson and his wife Candy, and Rolf's been working on the wolf study
there
for decades and took it over from Durwood Allen at Purdue. And I think it's safe to say they were a little frustrated by the way, the direction things were going, and I think felt that the ship had sailed on trying to intervene on behalf of the wolves, at least the wolves that are there, if there are any there at all. That's another discussion point. But we'll see where it goes and see if the callers want to hear more about that.
David, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You may have a wildlife question, maybe about Isle Royale, but maybe you have a comment or question about what's going on here in Wisconsin with our wildlife. Please call in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question and maybe a wildlife photo on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, that's our title, and you can post your questions or your comments there. We'd certainly love to hear from you. There, you know, last show, I wanted to bring it up before I forget about it. We talked a little bit about taxidermy, and I, you know, people are probably wondering, again, Scott, maybe you can just summarize what you were asking about and what resulted from it.
Well, the genesis of it, I guess, was over the years as I was on campus, people would call and say, gee, I have grandpa's taxidermy collection, or I've got this bull moose mount over the fireplace or whatever, and, you know, I'm tired of dusting it, cleaning it, we'd like to see it have a new home. So we offered to essentially, I guess, be the broker for trying to match up willing donors with willing recipients. And, you know, we just said, hey, if you've got some stuff around the house, get in touch with us, and we'll see if we can find a home for it. Well, as it worked out, there was as you would expect, for about 2 days after the program. There was quite a flurry of email traffic. But it was running about 60 or 70, 40 or 30 in favor of recipients as opposed to donors.
Ah.
So there were a few people who had things that they wanted to see find a new home. But for the most part, it was teachers, people at nature centers and whatnot who said, boy, you know, if you end up with a big pile of stuff, we'd sure like this or that or the other thing. I knew the demand was out there. But I was surprised that, you know, more things didn't turn up.
Yeah.
Some were very good and easy to place. One of your friends and colleagues and former students offered up a beautiful mount of a lake trout that she had just caught and spent a princely sum on having mounted. But it was a really nice mount, and I immediately thought of the new visitor center, nature center, the Ridge of Sanctuary in Door County.
Oh, sure.
Right there on
perfect.
The lake where lake trout are. It was a perfect match.
Yeah.
And anyway, got them together, and the lake trout was turned over to them a week ago.
Perfect.
So they're happy, and she's happy, and that was the kind of thing we envisioned happening. So it's still, things are still trickling in, and we're still trying to find homes for a few things. But anyway, that was the gist of the whole mess. So
somebody could still call you if they had something they wanted to donate, or what? Send you an email.
Send me an email. You know, if there are things out there that, you know, I guess part of it was an issue of how do I delicately say this? Some mounts, well, you know the situation with taxidermy. It's either really good and it looks like the actual animal, or it can be
not so good
and weathered and so forth. So, you know, we were looking for the kind of thing that had some scientific and educational merit. So if things still turn up, you know, we may mention this, you know, every time for a few months and see what turns up. But that was what we were doing, and I think it worked in at least a few cases.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have more callers online. Michelle in Oakland up next. Hi, Michelle.
Hello there. I'm so glad you're doing something on Isle Royale.
Oh, you visited there.
30 years worth of backpacking and kayaking, and my health gave out a couple of years back, but my husband is still going, and he's up there right now as we speak.
Wow. So you've been 30 times at least then.
Yes, from about 1979 on through the 2000s, and like I say, Rex still goes up there, so I want to give a shout-out to him.
Well, oh, that's wonderful.
It's that kind of place, Larry. I think people who go think, wow, this is really cool and I need to come back here.
It's
a great place to kind of recharge your batteries because you are.
That's exactly what he says.
Yeah, you're out of touch with the modern world, and you're just there thinking about, oh, where am I going to hike next? Or let's see if the Northern Lights are out tonight, which
right.
we did get one nice night of viewing.
And he got blessed about 2-3 years ago now. He saw two wolves.
You know, a lot of people think, okay, I'm going to go to Isle Royale and we'll hear wolves howling and we'll see wolves and there'll be moose behind. Hardly anybody ever sees a wolf. Even when they peaked out at around 50 animals, now it's down to maybe 2.
I know.
So the likelihood of seeing a moose, or well, the moose opportunity is growing by the day.
Right.
The wolf opportunity is heading the other direction.
Right. We saw a sad thing in 1996 when the moose population got so huge that they just died on the trails.
Mm.
They were just starving, and they had eaten all their food, and it was a horrible scene.
Well, there have been some boom and busts in the past, and there was a big crash in the 90s, as you suggest, and that is probably the direction they're headed, and I think that's why the Park Service is asking for some advice on what people think the intervention should be, if any. It is a natural laboratory, so
there's no hunting there, right?
No.
So,
well, that's another issue that comes up in terms of whether one of the solutions should involve some type of culling or direct management of the moose population, but that is all very contentious.
Yeah. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. It is kind of sad in a way you kind of wish the wolves would be, you know, make a comeback, but you wonder why they left why they died out in the first place.
Well, that's an inbreeding problem. I think they've pretty much determined that there's been so little infusion of new blood, so to speak, over the last few decades that inbreeding has caught up with them. And when they found three wolves on the aerial surveys this past winter, one was small. It had spinal deformities. They didn't think that one would live long, and it probably is no longer alive. But the dead wolves that they've had access to for study have had all sorts of anomalies that they traced to inbreeding, which was why it was so important to either new wolves come over, and there was ice across from Canada last winter. Apparently two wolves came over from either the Minnesota coast or Canada. One had a radio collar on from a study on the mainland. And those wolves kind of wandered around on the west end of the island for a couple of days and whoosh, hot-footed it back to the mainland. That could have been, you know, an infusion of a couple new animals, but it didn't work out. So we'll see.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist at UW-Madison. Just to let you know, at 1 o'clock today, could the Wisconsin John Doe case, if brought before the Supreme Court, usher in a new expanded victory for political action committees? Kathleen Dunn talks about that at 1 o'clock. Again, right now, we're visiting about the world of wildlife. And Judy in Ripon has a question, Scott. Let's go there. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I called about this a couple months ago, like in spring, but I had to drop off the phone because I couldn't hang on. But I know that there's rattlesnakes in western Wisconsin, southwestern Wisconsin particularly. But my neighbor, because we live in Ripon, so that's central Wisconsin, said that he saw one in his woodpile, and he was quite surprised, came across it. But this he told me right after I had spoken to an exterminator who I had called for ants, and he was talking about the fact that he had set out a live trap for someone in Ripon, and when he opened the live trap, there was a rattlesnake in the live trap. And my neighbor's pretty reliable. I would trust that he knew what he was seeing and knew what he was talking about. How is it possible that we're suddenly having these in central Wisconsin? I know that some other snakes can mimic them, but I didn't see it myself. But is it possible that they're here? And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Well, first and most important by far, Judy, is our Larry's and my disclaimer that we've learned over a long, long time of doing this that nothing is impossible when it comes to animals on the landscape because people are part of the equation. Yeah. So things get moved around and whatnot. Having said that, the likelihood of a rattlesnake in Ripon is pretty, pretty low. And the reality is that there are several blotched snakes that are very common and look something like a rattlesnake, at least in coloration, and can be quite large. And a couple of them even have learned over evolutionary time to shake their tails so that they vibrate in dry grass or vegetation, and you even think, oh, I think I hear a rattlesnake. But while they are distinctive, if you know your snakes and the head shape and the eye pupil and all that stuff, confusion with other snakes is the rule of the day when we deal with these kinds of things. Now, so we're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place here. I think the likelihood that there were rattlesnakes in that area is very, very low, but not impossible. And the one that is perhaps more plausible than the other is the Massasauga or swamp rattlesnake that had a little wider range in the state at one point and is usually found in kind of lowland or damp habitats. So while it's possible, it's highly unlikely, and the only way that we could really take it to the next level of discussion is to have a photo or some other documentation beyond what the exterminator or the neighbor claimed to have seen.
I think the head of the head of the rattlesnakes are different from the head of the non-poisonous snakes that look like rattlesnakes?
All of our other snakes, the head is just basically an extension of the body, and there's no tapering behind the head that would suggest a neck, whereas both the rattlesnakes have a very distinctive, large, wedge-shaped head, which is in part caused by the need for space there to store or to house the venom glands. But that's the most obvious thing, but I don't know what to say here. It's a long shot, but not impossible, but we would need, in order to pass it on or say any more about it, we'd need some other evidence.
John in La Crosse, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I love your wildlife show.
Thank you.
I was raised in Clark County, and I'm 61 now. And when I was a kid driving around or walking up and down the roads, it was hard not to see red-headed woodpeckers.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen them in years until just earlier this year. I was in southeastern Minnesota walking through the Indian burial ground area, and I saw one, and I was so startled and surprised to see one, I just had to stand there and watch for as long as I can see it. So I'm just wondering if there's something that we can do to bring back the red-headed woodpeckers and also the meadowlarks that used to be so common. Is there something we can do?
Well, first of all, John, you're right. Both birds have been in decline for a long time, and as a result, certainly Wisconsin and I think probably most states in their range have had programs designed at attempting to stem the decline, not only in red-headed woodpeckers and meadowlarks, but in many birds that required open grassland savanna kind of habitats. Red-headed woodpeckers were most visible in southwestern Wisconsin in kind of open forest areas. I often saw them on a telephone pole. There are, in my mind, next to the pileated woodpecker, the most spectacular woodpecker to see. Distinctive black and white, look like they're in a tuxedo with the whole head is bright red.
Yeah.
So the name red-headed woodpecker means something there rather than that feeble little red spot on the back of the head of a hairy or downy or what have you. So they're both very attractive birds and both keyed in to the same types of habitats. Obviously, trees are important to the red-headed woodpeckers, not so much to the meadowlarks, but their decline is reflective of a change in habitat related to agricultural landscapes and construction and development and a whole host of things that have affected our grassland and open savanna habitats. So that's what's been going on, but there are a lot of people concerned in dealing with it. There are grassland habitat restoration areas in Wisconsin that the DNR has been working on for a long time, and both of these birds are of concern to the agency and to people who came to like them over the years. So I think in terms of what you can do, unless you control a big block of habitat, probably not much other than awareness. I mean, they're not birds that are going to come to a birdhouse or a bird feeder kind of thing or what you might do in a backyard. But you can certainly log on to the eBird website or the DNR Natural Heritage website, and there will be information on both of those sites about both birds and other birds in the same group by habitat use, and you might get some ideas there. But your concern is right on, and that's basically what's happened.
Unfortunately, John, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate it. Just, we had a related, in a way, a related email question from Tom wondering if there's a subspecies of hairy woodpeckers with long beaks. We see this bird at our window feeder regularly. All markings and size are that of the common hairy woodpecker, but the beak is at least 3 inches long. That is...
Holy mackerel. Well,
I hope you get a photo of that one.
There's a couple of things. Obviously, downies and hairies are often confused, and it's beak length that helps separate them. The hairy is bigger and has a bigger, heavier, longer bill. If they're sure it's a hairy and they've seen other hairies, so that there's a three inch
that's long
is really long. And of course there's some individual variation, but that really seems to be out of the range of individual variation too. So I have there's no other There's no other woodpecker that would have a beak that long and still look like a hairy or downy. And that
seems...
Yeah,
look at your finger. That's as long as a finger.
Yeah, so I don't know what's going on there. But again, that would be something that if it's at the window feeder regularly, should be able to get a good picture of it and send it into Larry's Facebook page. And we will...
would love to see that.
We will have a look and pass it on to our ornithologist colleagues who may have some comment.
And here's one you're probably not going to be able to answer, but it's an interesting photo on Facebook. Jay sent, he said, this poor grasshopper is getting eaten up, and it's a red kind of, I'm not sure what it is, wondering what it is that's eating the grasshopper up. It's not a...
Well, I need to get up here so I can get to the screen.
Yeah, so it looks like some sort of...
Those look like eggs.
Oh.
Let me get back to the microphone. So it looks like some parasitic insect, perhaps a wasp of some kind, has laid eggs on the back of the grasshopper, unless there's some sort of grasshopper that somehow carries its eggs on the back. You know, there are other examples of fish and other species of creatures where the males carry or guard, and in some cases even house the eggs and young in their mouths. So this may be some bizarre form of grasshopper, and the eggs belong there.
Eggs.
It's a really neat picture, but on the other hand, I think it's more likely that it's some type of parasite that has laid its eggs on the back of the grasshopper, and those will eventually, you know, the grasshopper is probably designed to be the ultimate food source for whatever hatches from those eggs.
Well, it's
that's
a cool,
weird. It's a very nicely done picture, and it's one that, you know, somebody like good old Phil would probably take a look at and say, "Ha ha, that's what that is."
I know exactly what that is.
So,
yeah. Well, I tell you what, it's a cool photo. Go to our Facebook page. The Larry Mueller Show is the title of our Facebook page, and if you on the left side of the page, there's something that says "Posts to Page," and if you click there, that's where you're going to see that photo. And hopefully some other photos. Maybe you have a wildlife photo you want to send along. Please do. Put it up on our Facebook page. We'd love to see it. Claire in Madison has a question for you, Scott. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry. Back to the woodpeckers for a minute. This is not why I called. But I think I read or heard somewhere that if you're able to leave your dying or dead trees standing, that they like to use those for homes, of course.
Yep.
That's,
you know, if there's not a safety issue, for example.
There are a whole host of wildlife species, birds, mammals, and even insects for which a dead tree is a great habitat. And, of course, woodpeckers are the primary excavators that will perforate the tree and make occupancy available for other species. So, sure, a dead tree is a great thing, but in most... You know, most suburban neighborhoods and whatnot, a dead tree is frowned upon because of the safety issues or potential firewood or whatever else. But in the countryside, where you can leave one, it's a great thing to do, and that's a good... I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Actually, I called, though, to ask a question to see if your expert has any ideas. Last winter, I saw a huge... Sorry about my dog. I saw a huge raccoon way up in a cottonwood tree, probably 40 or 50 feet up in the dead of winter, and his shoulders were working like crazy, and I thought, what on earth is he after? I know raccoons will eat almost anything, but I was just curious if your guest has any ideas what that could have been.
Could have been after in a nest, maybe a squirrel's nest or something.
I couldn't see any nest, so if it was a nest, it wasn't a big one, but...
You know, unless there was a wasp nest or something up there that you couldn't see that they had found and were going after the larvae. I mean, a cottonwood tree doesn't produce much that they'd be interested in as a food source from the tree, but they're good climbers, and they certainly occupy trees and whatnot and use them for den sites. But what it might have, I guess I'm not sure what you mean by their shoulders were really going. They were after something or working their forepaws,
yeah.
But
exactly. He looked like he was almost digging at something, not necessarily in, but it's hard to describe.
Well, No, I understand the difficulty, and it's often tough to kind of put into words what people have seen, but speculating on what might have gotten up there somehow, you know, a bird got impaled on a branch, or a raptor, you know, took a squirrel up there or something that it had killed and left. It was the raccoon drove it off and had its prey or something like that. We could speculate on dozens of things, but no easy explanation.
Yep. There you go, Claire. Just a cool sight. Something cool to see. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, we got a note from Jeff in the University of Wisconsin Botany Department. He said, this morning, we got several photos of a probable mink in the botany garden on University Avenue.
Excellent.
That is very, and there's no reason why you wouldn't.
No, I mean, there have been mink along the lakeshore here along campus for many, many years, and they do roam. It used to be much more common because the university had the old mink farm down by the Biotron, and escapees were found all over the place. But this is more likely a wild mink, and they travel over land. So whether they were going from Mendota to Wingra or Wingra to Monona or Monona to the creek or whatever, who knows? But that's a pretty cool thing to see.
Very cool. And so, hey, Jeff, post a photo up on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show and post it. We're going to go to Mary in Merrimack next. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. Say, I've got a question about flying squirrels. About a month ago, right around dusk, we were entertained for about 40 minutes by four or five flying squirrels. One even swooped by almost my face, that close. We were stood out on the deck and watched them. And we never saw them again. Do they, move around a lot?
Well, they do. I mean, they can. But the real problem with people seeing them or not seeing them is that they're really strictly or highly nocturnal. So,
I looked it up on the internet.
Yeah, their activity is really restricted to after dark unless somebody disturbs a den site. For example, cutting a dead tree in the winter for firewood when the thing shatters when it hits the ground if it's hollow. Oh, look at all those flying squirrels. But other than that, people don't see them unless they get into a home and become a bit of a pest like a red squirrel or a gray squirrel.
Uh-huh.
The only time they're very visible is when people get them conditioned to coming to a bird feeder. Especially, say, a shelf feeder on a deck that's got seeds on, and the flying squirrels will glide in from their den tree or surrounding trees and womp onto the feeder and eat, and then away they go. And
it's funny that we've never seen them before because we're surrounded by woods, and and we're frequently out in the evenings after dark. And that was the only time. And after I saw them, I started really looking every night for them. And never saw him again.
Well, given the number involved, I suspect, and the time of year, it was probably a litter of youngsters.
Yeah, they acted young, and they acted like young teenagers, having a gay old time up there.
That was probably a litter that was finally mature enough to be out and about and were still behaving together remaining together and behaving a little bit atypical for a more seasoned flying squirrel. And that's probably what you saw. And it may be that if those were young ones, they simply dispersed after that encounter and went off to find their own den tree, and they're operating individually or somewhere else. So
yeah, there you go.
But if you want to see them again, put out a feeder if you don't have one and make sure it's filled at night. And if you get them coming in, sometimes they're a little leery of bright light, but if that's the case, you can use a red filter on a floodlight or whatnot, and then get them eventually conditioned so you can flip the light on and watch them scampering around on the feeder.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Mary. Appreciate it. And Michael in Banbury up next. Michael, hi.
Well, hello, Larry, and to your guests. Just a little bit of, and I think you just explained why the red-headed woodpecker, I hadn't seen one for the 10 or so years I've lived here. Then we had this big wind blowdown, and this was your guest's comment was that you need fallen trees, and we've got a lot up here. We lost several thousand trees. And then for the last 3 years, I've had this first one woodpecker came the first year, then it was two, and I have a set of four. And the same thing with the pileated woodpeckers. I have now two families with each one of them have a juvenile this year.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So and they come onto my back deck, and what really attracts them to help their fellow, they only eat the suet and right. the block suet. They don't. I've got sunflower seeds, thistles, and stuff. They don't eat any of that stuff. They only eat the suet, and it's right on my back deck, and now they stand on the railing of the back deck, and they're, you know, so time has come, and they've gotten comfortable, but it's really something to see, and they are red.
Yep, they're very pretty, and all the woodpeckers are readily attracted to suet, and yeah. That is one thing anybody can do for all the species of woodpeckers if you want to see them up close and personal.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Michael. Appreciate it very much. In fact, to go along with that, writing from Sister Bay, Wisconsin, Barbara said, we believe we have a family of three pileated woodpeckers in our area. We see and hear them almost every day, and they are spectacular. They love our suet. Although they can go through a block of suet in unbelievable time, perhaps if others want to attract, they could, you know, suet, as you say, Scott, would be the trick. And Barbara certainly agrees with you on that. We have Nancy in La Crosse up next. Nancy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I think Scott may have answered my question somewhat. It was also about flying squirrels.
Ah.
And we have the flying squirrels, but the problem with if you turn the light on to observe them, then, of course, it scares them. But you mentioned a red filter, and I guess I'm not really familiar with that. If you could kind of go in more detail, please.
Well, generally speaking, for stuff that's spooked at night, a red light is less spooky to them or frightening than bright white light. So you can actually get red light bulbs. You can buy red floodlights, especially around the holiday season, you know, red sure. and green ones and all to put out around the house. But I suspect at a lighting store you can find a red one with no problem. In some cases, there'll be lights that have interchangeable colored lenses, so you can have, you know, blue, put on your own psychedelic show at the house, or blue lights and red lights and green lights and whatever. But red seems to be the color that causes them the least anxiety, and I think you could slowly wean them off the red light, which is a little, yes, you'll be able to see the flying squirrels better, but it's not the most pleasant light to look at. And I've heard of people over the years that started out that way and then eventually got them used to going back to the normal floodlight. And in some cases, you can get to the point where they're completely oblivious to whatever you're doing or to the light. Food's a pretty powerful motivator.
Yeah.
If they're hungry enough.
Yep, there you go.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks a lot, Nancy, for calling. Appreciate it. We have, we have lots of comments on our Facebook page. Here's one, Scott, I don't know if you're going to be able to tell, but Rick Campbell, and Rick doesn't say where he's from, but he has some tracks, and he says, are these wolf tracks or are they coyote tracks? And oh, he's got a $0.50 bill that he shows next to the track. So the track looks to be, I would say, roughly a dollar bill is 6 inches long. So that looks to be about 3 inches.
Well, that's sort of on the upper side of coyote track. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. It would make a big difference. Well, it wouldn't make such a huge difference anymore where he was.
Oh, this was Lafayette County.
Yeah, I mean, by the odds and by the size and so forth, I think coyote is the correct answer.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here talking with Scott Craven, wildlife specialist, emeritus professor in UW Extension and UW-Madison's Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and we have open lines. If you have a question, comment, maybe you've got a photo to share with us for our Facebook page, but give us a call at 800-642-1234. email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Again, the Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. And there was a Facebook question from Sean who wonders about the status of chronic wasting disease in northwestern Wisconsin's deer herd. Hopefully it's zero.
Well, yeah, hopefully the status in the northwest and in most of the state, other than the, you know, the southern third and a couple of pockets where they found that one case up around Clam Lake and others in central Wisconsin, hopefully it is zero, but it's still, sadly enough, alive and well in the core area, as they call it, in southwestern and southern Wisconsin, and the spread seems to be increasing, albeit slowly. The incidence rate, or how what percentage of the herd is infected, seems to be continuing to increase, and the policy on it is simply
let it go.
Let it go. So we'll see what happens. It's you know, it's really at the point now where, you know, I've hunted in the same place in Iowa County for 40 years or more, mm-hmm. and it's getting to the point where you think about what sex and age deer you want to harvest, because the mm-hmm. likelihood of a sick animal is so high that the time and effort invested in processing a deer only to have to throw it away after the mm-hmm. fact is discouraging, at to say the least. So. Sean, if you're up in the northwest or northeast, keep your fingers crossed so you don't have to deal with what we do down here. But for right now, I think you're in the clear.
Patrick in North Lake up next. Hi, Patrick.
Hi there. The question I have is I've lived on the lake here for 39 years, and it's about seagulls. When I get out here in the spring, there's no seagulls on the lake, and then like in late June and July, I might see two or three, five of them or so. Then in August, it seems like there's 20, 30 or more that congregate on an island, and now at the beginning of September, they all disappear. And I'm just wondering what that pattern might be or what it is.
Well, Patrick, I mean, there are a variety of things that bring gulls together. They certainly congregate on suitable nesting sites, whether it's a nesting island or a breakwater or a rooftop or Larry's boat hoist or whatever, so that there can be tremendous concentrations for nesting purposes. Then there are tremendous concentrations for food sources, and it may be something artificial, like a landfill. Everybody knows how they congregate around open dumps or landfills, but also later on in the summer when fields are being plowed, or in the spring, there's tremendous numbers following plows because they're turning over grubs and earthworms that they feed on. So nesting, food sources, and then congregations in spring and fall in preparation for migration or movement. They don't all necessarily spend the winter here, although they need open water. So there's at least three, and there's probably more, explanations and various sub-explanations within those as to why you see large numbers of gulls in one place at one time, depending on the season and the location.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Patrick, for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Lots to talk about yet, Scott. I know the hunting seasons are, well, mourning dove started September 1st, runs to November 29th, and Canada goose hunting starts September 1st through September 15th. That's the early season hunt.
Right. And the early teal season, the small ducks that mm-hmm. Opened up again yesterday, but only runs for 7 days, and that's in the second year of kind of an experimental hunt. So right now, it's doves and geese and teal, and then a couple of those will phase out fairly quickly. And then the next big opener is September 12th with the deer season for crossbows and archery. And that there'll be lots of people out for that, but hopefully it cools off a little bit. It is too hot, mm-hmm. Too hot to be out in the field for some people. generally the outlook for all, and then there'll be other openers that kick in later September for ducks, and in October grouse and squirrels, yeah, and the gun deer season, and the bear seasons will be opening up quickly and so on. So anybody interested in this kind of thing, either because they're a participant or a potential participant, or they just want to know when hunters will be afield, keep your eyes on the regulations and the DNR website, because yesterday kicked it all off, and things will run well into winter. The deer seasons alone will run until January 3rd, and other things like squirrels and rabbits and grouse will run into the first month or two of winter. The outlook for all these things is now available on the DNR website. There are lots of forecasts and data available. Generally speaking, I think the people I talk to are looking for a pretty good fall hunting season, maybe a great one for some species, mm-hmm. Continental waterfowl populations, as they have been for the last couple of years, are at all-time historic highs, yeah. More ducks than we've ever had since people paid attention to how many ducks there were. So lots of ducks continentally. The deer herd is doing well, but it's not as easy to get a measure of that because the DNR, thanks to the Deer Czar report, no longer has much of an emphasis on numbers. So, you go by, I'm seeing a lot or I'm not seeing very many, and that's about what you end up with. The grouse population may be one of the low points, I guess, and that's actually mm-hmm. what it is. It's a low point in the grouse cycle of roughly 10 years, so hopefully we're bottoming out this year and things will get better in years to come, but rough grouse will be plentiful in some pockets of great habitat, but scarce in a lot of the landscape in the North Country. They'll be stalking a large number of pheasants again later mm-hmm. on. That opens in mid-October, I think the 17th. And as far as bears are concerned, the bear population's stable at 25,000, perhaps plus a few. And the past six seasons have all been records as far as bear harvest. And this year, there's a record number of permits at 10,690, for which there were 109,000 applicants. So demand mm-hmm. continues to exceed supply by a long shot.
1 in 10 chance.
Wait times to get a bear harvest permit, depending on the zone, varies from 1 to 9 years. And, last year, 4,500 bears, give or take a few, were harvested. So there should be at least that many and maybe more this year. A couple big changes. One on the bear side, since we're talking about them, the so-called Class B license, which was basically for assistants, people who could help with baiting or pursuing bears or a backup shooter or whatever. That was eliminated by the legislature. And the big change on the deer side is that we will be going to all electronic or telephone registration this year. It was done experimentally last year. Leftover permits for deer, for turkeys, where available, are still for sale. So if you missed out on that and want one, go online and buy what you want. But overall, we're just on the cusp of the hunting season. It will cool off. There are some signs of it. As I drove down from Houghton a couple days ago, there was a little orange and yellow appearing on some of the swamp maples. So it's coming. So
there we
that's kind of the hunting season update.
Well, let's get a fox update from Gary in Milwaukee next. Hi, Gary. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, no problem. I was out on a service call one Sunday morning, probably about 2 weeks ago. So 83rd in Hampton, I witnessed a fox running down the street. Actually, she was running away from one of the residents who was following behind with a can of coins or something, shaking it, trying to drive it away.
Scare it away?
Yeah, she was pretty upset, because she says that it takes... They're small animals and pets and things, which, I'm sure they will do. But, you live in an area with a piece of wildlife. You just need to take heed of it and know what you can do and what you can't do around it.
Yeah, that is right in Milwaukee.
Right in Milwaukee, in the heart of the city, I would say. it's not uncommon. I mean, a few years ago I saw, I thought it was a gray fox. It was, dusk or something, but it was out prowling looking for food.
Gary, thanks a lot. It just brings back to mind something we've talked about a few times, the number of fox, like in Madison, now Milwaukee and Madison and other metropolitan areas, it's not unusual anymore to see them.
It's not at all unusual. The urban environment, whether it's downtown Milwaukee or a suburb of any of our communities around the state, the urban wildlife community is very abundant and very diverse, and it would surprise people greatly to know what's out there roaming around, perhaps when they're not paying attention. But seeing a fox is not at all extraordinary in just about any community anymore in Wisconsin.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. And Dave in Waukesha, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I saw something the other day. I was looking out my, I got a patio out here, and I was looking out the blinds, and it was moving. We got a, like a common area out back, and it was about 16 to 18 inches long. It moved like a weasel, and it was probably about as big around as my wrist.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a fisher or something?
No. Well, let me ask you about color. It was dark chocolate brown or kind of mahogany colored.
It was very dark.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from the size you're describing and the diameter of your wrist, it sounds to me like it was a mink.
Yeah.
So the mink sighting in the botany garden here on campus that we talked about a couple minutes ago is probably what you saw. Do you have any water anywhere around you? Creek, pond, anything?
We're up on kind of a hill, and there's no open water. There is water about a half mile off.
Well, I mean, that's certainly on the... There are a number of members. So this was, let me go back to basics. It was kind of a long, skinny animal, tubular looking.
Yes.
Okay. So on the one hand, we have three or four actual weasels, short tail and long tail, but they'd be skinnier than your wrist and probably would appear shorter. So the next weasel or member of the weasel family up in size would be a mink. And, you know, young ones could be out roaming around this time of year. The color fits, the size fits. I think even though it may not be immediately near water, I think weasel, mink rather.
Mink is it. Okay. Thanks, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. He'll be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back with Scott. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife. We have a great cohort of wildlife in our state and a great guy, Scott Craven, to talk about it. Scott's a wildlife ecologist, a emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin in the departments of UW Extension and Forest and Wildlife Ecology. You may have questions for him. You can go on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, post photos, of which we're getting a lot of photos right now. Questions there. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Gavin in Janesville has been waiting a while, Scott, so let's go there. Gavin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. How are you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Well, I just really want to compliment, you know, Scott for his contribution to public radio, for one thing, and his intelligence.
Thank you.
And, you know, I swear to God, it must have been my brother that called, my brother Sean. About chronic wasting. Yeah, he's a taxidermist in Janesville, and you know, he's been doing chronic wasting testing for the DNR, you know, because he's got a deer tick in point. So, but anyway, I just actually the only reason I called, I didn't see no wild critters, but just compliment, you know, Larry yourself and Scott for
wow. His
contribution to public radio.
Thank you very much. That's very nice to hear.
Very much appreciated, Gavin. It's kind of one of those things that you think, well, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? And then you get comments like that, and you know why you're doing it. So I appreciate it very much, and we'll keep doing it. Ann in Hortonville has a comment. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I really enjoy your show here. We were going up to the Apostle Islands and Bayfield. We got back from that trip, but on our way up there, we had stopped at Minocqua.
Yeah.
Overnight, and we this is a bus trip to Nationwide. So we went to Northwoods Wildlife Center. This was initially started by a vet in Malacca, and he was getting more wildlife to take care of than cats and dogs. So he started this wildlife center. You can tour through part of it, and then there's some one part that only certain people get to go through or to go where. And that's where they have wildlife that they are trying to repair, fix, and so they can release them. So they don't want a lot of people there to have a lot of human contact with these wild animals.
Right.
And it was fascinating. They survive on donations and volunteered. So it was a good place.
That is, and Scott, a comment on that?
Well, I mean, I'm glad that Ann is plugging the Wildlife Center. It's been there a long time. They do good work. They're one of many wildlife rehabilitation centers across the state, and there's quite a network of individual rehabilitators that aren't necessarily connected with a center like that. So, I mean, those people are essential. People are concerned about wildlife. They're concerned about the well-being of individual animals. And it's since most people are not equipped to take care of sick or injured wild animals, then we rely on this network of licensed and trained and experienced and good-hearted rehabbers to do that for society and for the animals themselves. So it works out great. And some of them are open for visitation, like the Northwoods Wildlife Center on Highway 70 West in Minocqua, and some are not. But those and the various nature centers around the state are always great spots to fill in on a vacation or trip. If you see one, say, hey, here's a spot we could stop for an hour or so and get a break from the road, and
there
you go.
There are some nice ones all the way. And I bet I wouldn't be surprised if Ann and or a lot of people wouldn't have stopped on their way to the Apostle Islands in, I suddenly blanked on it, but up on the, there's a great center, Great Lakes Center, and
Great Lakes Visitor Center in Ashland.
That's it,
yeah, on the west side of Ashland. It's a Park Service facility, and it's a beautiful spot to spend a little time. Great exhibits and plenty of place to get out and stretch your legs. And there are lots of places like that.
Well, you know, you were just at the opening of the Horicon Marsh Explorium, as they call it.
Yep.
And we've talked about it a couple times on the show, but it's great that you had a chance to visit and actually see it.
Well, the Horicon Marsh Education and Visitor Center has been open for a couple of years now, but they had the foresight to develop the space in their new buildings that would eventually house this what they're calling the Explorium, but it's essentially a hands-on, sensory-laden experience to allow visitors to kind of go through the history of the marsh from the Ice Age to the present time. The grand opening was a couple Saturdays ago on the 22nd of August, and I was lucky. I had a board meeting there for the Natural Resources Foundation the week before, and they gave us kind of a preliminary look at the exhibits, and they were just spectacular. I mean, really well done by a company out of Illinois, a design studio that built them. It took a while, but it was well worth waiting for. So the Explorium is now open, and they encourage basically visitors of all ages to look, listen, touch, and even smell. They have kind of like a scratch and sniff sort of thing for some stuff so that they can explore changes in the marsh over thousands of years. You kind of go in through a fabricated glacier, and there's a cool breath of air, and you see a mammoth head, and there's actually the smell of fresh mammoth scent. And so there's a lot of stuff like that. In addition to a simulated airboat ride, airboats are used as a management tool on the marsh. There's a replica water control gate similar to those that control water levels in the marsh today, and decoy collections and history of the exploitation of the marsh for agriculture and for duck hunting and a whole slew of other things leading up to the current situation where the northern two-thirds is controlled by the federal government is Horicon National Wildlife Refuge, and the southern third is run by the DNR. But anyway, the Explorium is now a key part of the visitor education or the Education and Visitor Center. It's open. Let me see the hours here: 7 days a week, except major holidays, 9 to 5 on weekdays, 10 to 5 on weekends. There's a small fee, but it's well worth it. It's on the southeast corner of the marsh, off Highway 28. It's very easy to find, and I would recommend a visit there too. It's a neat place.
Dave in Janesville has a question for you, Scott. Dave, hi. Thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, Larry and Scott. A couple of weeks ago, looking out the window one night about 10 o'clock, we have a lit path going around the house. A badger shows up at our pond for a drink of water.
Hmm.
We live in town. I've got kind of a natural native landscape, prairie and so on. But this critter had to, you know, come through a neighborhood or two to get here. And just wondering, is he just passing by pretty droughty or is he going to become a resident?
Not likely a resident in the backyard. I mean, they're less tolerant of intense human activity than some other animals that we just talked about in the context of urban wildlife, but they do cover some ground occasionally as they're moving or dispersing, and it may have just stopped by. It sounds like you've got a nicely developed yard, and they probably found it a nice wayside along the way, whatever that way might be, stopped for a drink and moving on. But most of our communities have corridors, whether they're old railroad corridors or a greenway that connects the park system or something. And as I mentioned, a lot of animals that people don't expect to see anywhere near the city travel some of these corridors and movement patterns at night. And the only way that they're going to be seen is if you happen to look out like you did and say, whoa, there's a badger. And in the case of a badger, with that black and white bucky badger face, we rarely have cases of misidentification. So you saw it that way. Other people put out, you know, these trail cameras or motion-sensitive cameras have become very popular. And even in a backyard or along a parkway or something like that, I think if you can deploy a camera without fear of it being swiped or vandalized, I think you'd be amazed at what you might see, even in an area where you don't expect wildlife to be abundant. But my guess is that the animal was just moving through, but you never know.
Never know, but I think I agree with you on that one, Scott. Dave, thanks a lot. Interesting comment. We had I want to bring up this Facebook question from Joy. You were talking earlier about the deer hunt and deer registration. And in the past, it's always, you know, you went to the local grocery store, bar, or whatever, and registered. Now it's going to be electronic. And Joy wonders, if it's electronic, how will age and condition and disease data be gathered? Or has that data gathering effort ended as well?
That's a very astute question, Joy, and I guess the short answer is that those data will, for the most part, be lost. There will still be some collection of information, especially in the chronic wasting disease management area, so there'll be some sampling done. But the database that had accrued to the DNR and their scientists over many years where those data were collected have essentially been truncated or ended. And even if they were still collected, part of the opportunity to interpret them has been confounded because, of course, again, as part of this new adoption of the DIRZARS report, the management units that those data were associated with are all no more as well. The deer are now being treated on a county-by-county basis, a rather artificial or politically-based scheme, as opposed to the old deer management units that had some basis in habitat or deer population or whatever. So Yeah, unfortunately, opportunities are going by the boards, and we're already compromised by other changes that are all part of the same package. But that's the way it is, and that's all I have to say about it.
Greg in New Glarus, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi, Larry and Scott. And thank you for this program. I've been a long-time public radio listener, and this one is one of my favorites.
Thank you.
Night before last, my wife saw an animal scurry up a tree near our garden, which as soon as this incident happened, she came in and started looking on the internet, and at first thought it was most likely a marten. And then after we looked on the internet and dug out an old mammal, North American mammal book I have, it looked more like, it sounded more like a fisher. Wondering mostly what the chances for that are. One interesting side story of this is that we've had a heck of a great, we're out of 3 miles east of New Glarus, so we're out in the country a little bit, and we had a heck of a good rabbit population this spring and summer. There were many times when I could look out the front yard and backyard and see one or more rabbits at a time in both areas, and we haven't seen a rabbit now in 10 to 14 days, I would say.
Well, the late season rabbit disappearance is a common phenomenon, and you know, I was battling them in the garden in my rural home for quite a while through about early August, and I haven't seen a rabbit for the last 3 or 4 weeks either. But back to the animal, what time of day did your wife see it?
I think it was about 7 p.m.
So it was full light.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was, I'm thinking, 35 to 50 feet away, and she heard it scurry up the tree.
So it was a brown.
And then she actually got a look at its whole body, dark brown to black, really dark, and it stopped and looked right at her. She said she got a pretty good look at the head, and it's she's describing it as at least 1.5 the size of our cat, which is an average 8-9 pound cat.
Well, okay, first of all, I assume that it had this weasel-like appearance, because there are other brown animals that will go up a tree, including even a woodchuck, which is a very good climber, but people don't see in trees very often. But they do climb. The likelihood of either a marten or a fisher, neither one is especially likely. They're both northern forest species, but the marten is a very rare animal, even in the recovery areas, Ford and the Northwoods. So that's a long shot. Long shot. Now, the fisher, on the other hand, while it was considered a northern third or half of Wisconsin animal, has been expanding its numbers and range further south, and there have been records of fisher in the last 4 or 5 years in Columbia County. Have a really nice picture of one in Governor Dodge State Park, not that far from you. So the dark color, the weasel-like appearance, the going up a tree fits with a fisher. Yeah. So either way, if it was a fisher, it's an unusual sighting, but that seems like the most likely explanation.
Yeah,
but probably not a marten.
Thanks very much, Greg, for calling. I want to give Nancy and Thorpe a chance to join us as well. So let's go there. Nancy, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
About 15, 20 years ago, I believe the season was the winter season or coolish season, and a weird sight I saw dead on the ground were like a dozen sparrows with their heads off. And I was wondering if you know what predator that would be that would do such a thing. I've never seen such a thing before, and it was just weird.
So when did you find these sparrows?
They were in the driveway. I don't know if it was in the morning time where they were dead. It was the coolest season, I believe. And like I said, it was 15, 20 years ago. And their heads were off. Their bodies were there, but their head, you know, someone ate the head.
Well,
so, someone said an owl.
Well, yes, some of the owls will attack the head. So will some of the weasels and so forth. But the real difficulty in the story, I can understand finding some animals that are headless, and there are predators that will do that. But sparrows fly, and how any predator could have caught and subsequently dealt with that number of sparrows on a driveway,
yeah.
I don't understand that at all.
Yeah, it was weird.
It is weird, and you know, even if an owl found a tree, if there was a tree nearby, sparrows tend to roost in trees at night when they're pretty vulnerable. Now, I suppose if there was a roost of sparrows there, and in that case, an owl would be the most likely predator, mm-hmm. and they were just able to work over that flock of sparrows, and the sparrows somehow didn't catch on that, hey guys, things aren't going well here, and they all ended up, you know, scattered on the ground under the tree, you know, maybe, but that whole thing seems a little far-fetched. So I don't have a very good answer for you. And the other possibility, of course, is that, you know, people take a dim view of some of these sparrow roosts, and there are various ways people have gone about doing something that would have killed the sparrows, and then they were dead under the tree and then scavenged by something that would have gone for the heads first. So I don't know what to tell you, Nancy. That one will remain for another 20 years a great mystery.
There you go. Oh, and Cynthia in Park Falls. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, I have had a gray fox that has been living in around our area. I live between Park Falls and Minocqua in the Pike Lake chain, and this fox barks at night, especially if I go out on my deck, then he'll start barking at me. And I was wondering, I mean, at first I realized it because I was hearing this barking outside, and it was it's kind of like a hoarse voice kind of a sound. Like a cough, and so, he did it, you know, he was around for probably a month or so. He hasn't been around the last few days, and I wondered, does he have a den and he's just defending it, or is he looking for a mate?
Well, barking,
I mean, that's the way one of the ways they communicate. They yip and bark and howl and so forth, and the fox may have just been, they could have very easily had a den very close to your home, and your presence at any time for any reason may have been construed as, she's getting a little close, let's bark at her. Or let's bark to our mate and go from there. So it's pretty normal communication, and having a gray fox settle in pretty close to people, and that's only about 6 miles from my cabin up there, too, if you're on the Pike Lake chain. So I'll keep an eye out for a barking fox and let you know, Cynthia.
And there's one in the last 30 seconds or so, Scott. You got an event you wanted to mention, too.
Yes, I was just asked to plug coming up on Saturday, October 10th at noon to 4 on the Gibraltar segment of the Ice Age Trail. There's a family fun day. It's an educational hike for families sponsored by Wisconsin Wild Care with a lot of cooperators, the Ice Age Trail Alliance, Madison Audubon, Four Lakes Wildlife Center. They've got all kinds of fun activities planned.
Free.
It's free. People can learn about local wildlife and see some exhibits from bat conservation groups and so forth. Anyway, if you want more information on this, go to Wisconsin Wild Care, just wywildcare.org. But it sounds like a fun thing to do on an October weekend.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Good program, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. He'll be back and do it again.
Tomorrow we're going to take a look at the book Cranberries Revealed, and then we'll get a sneak peek at a movie filmed in Door County called The Emissary. That should be fun. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate it.